We're going to go ahead and get started, and it's going to be really informal, and I think probably I'll do the monitoring here and just calling on people, and I'm going to be sitting down at the table with everybody else. I think I'm going to, is it on? Okay. I think I'm going to start by asking Laurie a question myself. There was some talk last night about what some of the statistics are showing about people leaving organized religion. And as we all know, people go from that to agnostic, atheist, spiritualism, Buddhism, whatever. Since you're involved with that kind of work, is that what you're seeing? Is that that's happening?
Absolutely. Is this on? Yeah. Hi. Good morning. Yeah, absolutely. What's really fascinating is the numbers that are dropping are the amount of people that are denomination switching, right? So we're actually seeing more and more people go into a secular identity, go into atheism or agnosticism. Even the spiritual, not religious category is kind of diluted. We're still trying to figure out
what that is.
What that means. But when you see that the category of spiritual nuns, N-O-N-E-S, is rising, that's really what's happening is they're not denomination switching. They're not jumping, you know, from, let's say, Mormonism to evangelical Christianity or anything of that nature. They really are just going into a secular identity, which makes me very excited.
I think it's interesting. My perception has been that a lot of ex-Mormons, there's not a high percentage who go into another organized religion, but it seems that those who do are, and you guys might be able to confirm this, that are going more to the evangelical, born-again Christian thing. And that's kind of the feedback I'm getting, but it isn't a very high number.
Right. What I want to know, maybe somebody can answer this, is, you know, to what degree are ex-Mormons actually identifying as atheists? You know, or as agnostics, because I hear so much about post-Mormons, you know, ex-Mormons, but are people making that switch to adopting an atheist or agnostic identity?
My perception is, I think again, especially with atheism, that it's not safe to identify as that yet in America.
That's true.
So a lot of it's just, I'm just searching. I hear a lot of people, and I think most people are. They're just going through a process, and who knows where any of us will end up. That's great. Okay, I'm going to open it up now.
Do we have a mic runner?
Oh, I didn't think about that. I forgot about that. Who wants to be a runner? I can do that.
He's now the mic runner.
You can just trade it to the next person.
I've been curious for a long time, and maybe somebody could help me. What are the Joseph Smith Papers? We go to the Megaplex Theater and we sit there watching, waiting for a movie to start, and they advertise the Joseph Smith Papers. What are they? Anybody know?
Can you answer that?
We can give it a shot.
Okay.
The church wants to quote only themselves in the Ensign magazine and in their articles and what have you, so they want to be able to control the interpretation of things, and that's why the Joseph Smith Papers are there. I think originally there was going to be, was it 30 volumes or 40? I think it was 30.
Yeah.
And it included all the court cases of that Joseph Smith was involved in, which have really never been published before. I understand now that has been dropped. They're down to 20 volumes. They are doing some good things, but, you know, they're not going to include everything like they claim. They want to be able to say, see, our books are open. We're an open book, and it's all going to come out there. But that's not true. I have a cousin who is very Orthodox. He and his wife were called on an 18-month mission to work on the Joseph Smith Papers. And I ask him, I says, well, what do you do? And he says, well, we go through documents and then we, you know, make sure they're legible and can, you know, type them up and so they can be used in the project. And I says, well, do you ever leave anything out? And he says, I don't, but some of my fellow workers do. They see a line that they don't like, they just kind of skip it because it might be a little embarrassing to someone. But they're getting really creative, you know. The William Clayton journals are really, really important. There's 4 or 5 of those journals. They're the basis of our history in Nauvoo. And now the Joseph Smith paper team has said, well, they're really not the writings of Joseph Smith, so we're not going to put them in the Joseph Smith papers. Well, that is kind of disingenuous in my position, because William Clayton was the personal secretary of Joseph Smith. He wrote down everything he said. And Joseph Smith didn't write down very much of anything. So to leave those journals out, which is the basis of our whole history in Nauvoo, Illinois, is a real blow to the project, in my opinion. So the short answer to your question is, they want the publicity that they're open and it's all coming out. They have done a few things. They have, for example, the Canadian copyright incident. They have that in the volume too. But these volumes are costing $100. And there's no way this is going to replace. Orthodox Mormons aren't going to run out and buy 20 volumes of expensive books. But it's kind of what they do. They milk history for what they can, and then but they're deniers of history. Anyway.
It's interesting, as you describe what some of the people are doing, they're deciding that a sentence or two shouldn't be in there. Immediately I flashed on the thing I always say about the Bible. When you think of the thousands of monks sitting in a monastery somewhere, you know, copying, translating, and deciding, oh, I don't like the way that sounds, you know, or I think this means this. I mean, the idea of taking the Bible literally is just beyond me, and always has been. If you would trade, did you give your mic to somebody? Okay. Another question? There's one right back here.
When I first started learning some of the historical inconsistencies with the church, the one thing that still I thought the church had going for it was the Book of Mormon. So, Grant, when I read your book, that fixed that. The amount of research between yourself and Tom, it has been exhaustive and extensive, and so for that, I'm very appreciative. Tom, yesterday you mentioned that there was some estimate figure of 75% of the Book of Mormon was...
That was Grant.
Okay. That 75% of the Book of Mormon was verifiably plagiarized from other sources via the Hebrews, Protestantism, Methodism, and the Bible, and various other sources. Is that 75% including all the research done by all known scholars? The other 25%, is that Joseph Smith's creative imagination?
No, you're doing great.
You can go on MormonThink.com, Grant Palmer homepage, and you can get this two. It's a two-page summary of my book, and on the Book of Mormon, I think that you can find 75% of the Book of Mormon came right out of Joseph Smith's backyard. It's his parents' biographical information. It's 22 to 25% of the whole Book of Mormon is the King James Bible, but Mormons don't know the Bible well enough to know that that's the case. But I've documented a lot, and the Tanners have documented a lot. So I'd say about 25% of the Book of Mormon is right out of the 1769 edition of the King James Bible, because it carries the errors of that edition. imagine 3 Nephi, chapters 11 through 28, which is the words of Jesus, essentially, coming right out of a 1769 edition of the King James Bible, when supposedly Jesus spoke all this stuff and it went on to gold plates by Mormon and Moroni and given to Joseph Smith, and instead he uses a King James Bible that wasn't even written until 1611.
Let me dovetail a point on there if I can. And if you remember,
before
I'm sorry.
You start, would it help if we turn off one of these mics and tell the user that echo you're getting? Okay,
it's all under control. If you remember yesterday too, I pointed out in some cases, if you read sermons, you're going to get paraphrased Bible, and you'll get exact paraphrase similarities in the Book of Mormon to the sermon, not the Bible. So Joseph Smith could also be picking up his Bible plagiarisms from sermons as like crib notes. And that's why when I mentioned Jonathan Edwards' Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, where he calls those sinners, he says they have hardness of heart and blindness of mind, which is a biblical paraphrase, and the exact paraphrase is in the Book of Mormon. It's more likely that he got Smith or whoever, Rigdon, got it from a sermon, because the odds of both of them coming up with the same paraphrase is a little against that, if that makes sense. So when Grant says 75% of the, you know, whatever's going on at the time, it's a big tent. A lot of things were going on at the time. And if you're a writer, you cannot write in a vacuum. You're going to remember somebody's name. You might pull it in. Any author, anybody who's written will write from their experience or experience of others.
Are we on now? There we go. I turned it off because we were getting feedback. Sorry. Is it all right if I ask two questions? Because I'd like to follow up on what you were just talking about. First of all, in that situation where he was pulling things out of the King James Version of the Bible, the people at that era would have known that this was coming from the Bible. They did. You know, that was the only book they had. So how does this speak to what the general populace that was following him thought about what he was saying? Because they would have heard these words and said, oh, well, hey, wait, I just read that, or something very similar to that. I mean, does that speak to the nature of what the individuals, when they were following him and what he was saying, what they, was going on in their minds? I'm not sure how those two dovetail together. Why they didn't call him out as a fraud then? Why they thought that wasn't fraudulent?
Just intuitive. Most people read it and went, pfft. But there were those gullible ones who believed in magic and would follow and do whatever they were told. And so I think that's why there was such a big division and persecution. Persecution was nothing more than, in a lot of cases, people saying, you know, this guy's a fraud. We don't have to explain it. It's apparent.
Yeah, read the early literature. They're on to him early. Alexander Campbell, the Boston Unitarian. There's early 1832, 1831, 33, 34. They all see the things that we're talking about. But who's embracing Mormonism? Like I say, the first 50 to 75 converts were into treasure hunting. I don't think they were reading the Bible that much. They were just, you know, they were the dispossessed in most cases. They had no political, social, economic clout. And they joined together and they got some.
Wouldn't it be true also that just a lot of them didn't know how to read to begin with? I mean, the only thing they did have usually was the Bible, and there were just a lot of illiterate people, and I'm sure a great many of the people who joined the church were probably illiterate.
Only 8% of the American population in 1800, 7% belonged to a church. 7%. And it was easy to get excommunicated. If you didn't show up for a certain amount of time, they lopped you off the rolls. Well, by the time of 1820, when Joseph Smith's having his vision, 11% of the American people belonged to a Christian church. I think this is one reason why Joseph Smith wrote the book, composed the Book of Mormon, because he wanted to bring people to Christ. He's just like the title page says. Well, then the Methodists started stirring, and they really put religion on the map in America, the circuit riders. People weren't coming to the churches, so they're going to take the church to the people. And they were very successful. So that by 1861, that's the high water mark of church attendance in America, 61%. And it's been going downhill ever since. Now it's in the, what, the mid-30s that claim they go. And the Pew research recently said 1 in 5 Americans don't belong to anything and don't claim any affiliation with any church. So the internet is killing organized religion.
Did you have one more?
Yeah, thank you for indulging me for a second question. I was going to start by saying this is my first conference, and I found the speakers, all of you, absolutely incredible. And thank you for the effort and the time you guys did.
Thank you.
Oh, it was really my pleasure. So again, this was something, Grant, that you mentioned, but of course I think maybe today, or at least at this time, the apologist groups are starting, you said they were being closed down, Fair and Farm, or Farms. And I just was wondering what other groups, I know this is kind of like, you know, the inside secret, you know, workings, but what other groups are out there right now that are inside of the LDS Church that are going to be replacing the same job they do about going after those that are you know, trying to point out the truth, or you know that are like trying to take down Mormon Think? Is there other, you know, the Foundation for Strengthening the Members Committee? Are there still groups like that that are identifiable that
Yes, I'm pretty sure the Strengthening Church Committee, or they change the name every once in a while, is still in play, because I wrote a very obscure article for a Baptist theological journal in Kansas City, and all I know is it's a 2-page thing. It was nothing. And the next thing I know, my stake president's on my front door telling me he must hold a court on me. And I knew it was because of my book. They've been looking for... The church likes to give you a little rope to hang yourself. And the guys was the use of this little article. I'm not sure I'm answering your question very...
You're wanting to know if Farms what's the other one? Fair disappeared. Are there other like groups coming along to take their place?
Yeah, I don't know whether they will reconstitute themselves, but they're definitely going in a different direction because the other direction wasn't effective. I just said last night that the apologists for the church have lost the war. They just don't have the bullets. They don't have the ammunitions to answer the critics over the last 25 years. Will there still be apology for the church? Oh, absolutely. But the church seems to be distancing themselves from apologist groups who are trying to defend the church, because they're not doing a very good job. And I don't know how they can do a very good job with what they've got to work with.
Well, they always have plausible deniability, too. Every article on any of those pages all say this author speaks for himself and not for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So if this is such good stuff, why doesn't the church get behind it? And they may find it's diminishing returns. To talk about it actually does more damage. They may discover that it would be worthwhile to not talk about anything, and they may actually gain ground.
Kathleen, right here.
No?
Well, we were from the beginning. So she's had her hand up for a while because she can get to my ear.
Sure. I would like to ask this question of any panel member who would care to comment. I'm really interested in the origin of the demonization of apostates, the use of the phrase under the control of Satan, the emphasis on shunning. So I'd just like to hear what you have to say from your own experience and your own background.
Hey, Raptor, why don't you take that one?
I think this one goes really, really far back, most likely to the beginning. It is very, very clear that that Joseph Smith needed that persecution complex, and Brigham Young definitely took it up. But as time went on, just the power that they needed Satan to have in order to keep people in line just perpetuated. And I know that you hear snippets of it everywhere in all of the talks, in all of the lesson manuals that deal with apostasy. All of the folklore still comes out that people only left the church for very, very petty reasons, and they ended up being very petty people, which you know, of course, isn't true when you dig into all of those stories about leaving over, you know, milk and crap like that, and because of those myths perpetuating, and just those snide little remarks that go in there, and even last conference, because I wasn't sleeping very well, so I decided to watch a lot of conference, there still were things in that about how it takes a lot of courage and strength to be a member of the church. Well, of course, that implies the opposite of that. If you leave, then you are weak and you are cowardly, you know, and you just, you know, just Satan, he just loves to, you know, have you in his clutches, his kung fu grip.
I can actually speak to that as well, in terms of the evangelicals' origins going back further than we know. But the use of it in contemporary society, it's so functional. It's so functional because it draws those boundaries, those necessary boundaries. So when you're labeling somebody as an apostate, you know, a heathen, a sinner, hellbound, or whatnot, you know, it's definitely drawing that line, us versus them, which is what the evangelicals need. And now the use of Satan in that is a social psychological form of control, right? They're using Satan to communicate a fear. This is why you don't leave. You're going to be like them. You're going to burn in hell. They're the bad ones. We're the chosen. And the use of Satan really, really reinforces that through fear. And it's, in my opinion, such a harmful way to do things. But they need those labels. They need those labels to draw those social and symbolic boundaries, because that really reinforces their mission and who they are and what they believe that they're called to do, you know, on this earth.
Well, you know, shunning is shunning is worldwide. Look in the Middle East. Didn't a young 14-year-old girl get shot in the head for reading a book? Ancient Buddha carvings were blown up by Islamic fundamentalists. What happened to Copernicus? What was his fate? I don't remember. I know he had a fate. What was it?
He published the year of his death and avoided things.
Oh, okay. Well, and that, you know, that shunning, I think it's just humankind in desperate straits. We're changing. We don't like it. We don't know where we're going. So the changer needs to be gotten rid of, because that's scary.
Under the control of Satan.
Not that I remember.
I think the us versus them thing is the most powerful sociological thing. And the church has honed that, you know, to a fine-tuned place. Because the minute you step out an inch, you're the other, you know. You become the other.
I think someone else has the mic. Oh, no, you've got the mic, sorry. Right here.
I'd like to give you some feedback, Laurie, based on the initial comment you made and our moderator mentioning process. That kind of triggered it off. I'm not an ex-Mormon, but I feel like I am sometimes because I came out here 14 years ago and I married a fanatical Mormon cult member, not a church member in my estimation. She died a couple of years ago. And I felt like when I came, I'm a retired clinical social worker from the East Coast, very liberal person. And when I came out here 14 years ago, after I figured out what the hell was really going on, I felt like I had died and gone to hell. And recently, I feel quite revived. I have a nice ex-Mormon wife who's here with me. What I wanted to say really was, I've been a spiritual person all my life, and that was one of your questions. And I thought maybe my feedback could be helpful to you. I came to the realization by the time I was 8 or 10 years old, having been sent to a Protestant Sunday school, that part of what they said was good Christian principles to live by, and part of it was a bunch of religious crap. And so my spiritual self is, in part, I suppose, I don't consider it to be a anti-religion, although I don't care that much for formal religion at all, for obvious reasons, but I think it's a natural need if somebody is not a, you know, let's say, a materialistic person. You naturally gravitate towards caring for other people, loving them, etc. And that's why I guess I moved along in my young life and became a mental health professional. The process you mentioned. Yes, from my perspective, ex-Mormons are always in the process of leaving the church. It's convenient to say I left at a certain time, a certain date. I've been out for a few years, but I doubt that most, maybe no ex-Mormons ever completely leave the church. That's where the need to look at it as a cult comes into place. You've been brainwashed. The fear, the guilt, are significant parts of it. It's like an addiction. And I'm an addict. I'm a smoke addict. I quit smoking 9 years ago, but I'll be a smoke addict for the rest of my life. I won't be a non-smoker. I just wanted to give the feedback about the process because I think there's an awful, as a clinical social worker, and I think it's very important for ex-Mormons to realize that they're always in the process of leaving. And they may need a lot of support groups. Some may need individual or group psychotherapy. I can certainly empathize with the struggle. It's a big struggle.
I think it's important with the comment made as far as that ex-Mormons are always leaving the church. I don't know if I can speak necessarily strictly to that, but what I will say is that I think it is good when Mormons leave, in my estimation, to not just simply walk away. I think it is good for when Mormons to leave to do some work with that upbringing just to make sure that some of those more harmful constructs about guilt and shame and things like that are analyzed within their own thought processes. Because Mormonism, Whether you agree with it or not, as far as being a cult, it does have a lot of authoritarian stuff. It has a lot of patriarchal stuff. It also teaches passive aggressiveness so well that I think it is good that when people leave, they take a look at their own thought processes for things like that.
And if I can just speak to the spiritual, not religious, and the reason this is so difficult, at least in the sociological literature, to get at is because, like I mentioned yesterday, we're measuring these things very quantitatively, right? So take all of your experiences, right, and quantify them by checking a box. And, you know, it's our position in sociology, most of us anyway, you know, that things are socially constructed, right? So spiritual belief is a social construction. You can pull from different parts of theology, different rituals, different, you know, cultural symbols to kind of inform what your beliefs are. And because we're not really talking to people, you know, and getting at the story of people who are identifying as spiritual, not religious, we don't really have a good sense of what that is just because it can be so many different things. So that's definitely really needed.
Sing on. Okay.
So just to
shout.
Did you turn it off?
Okay, just to carry on with that, I had a question for Grant. One, I know over the past 10 years you've been through a lot. I haven't really been following what's happened to you over the last 10 years. I know that you were disfellowshipped, and then after that they told you basically not to publish anything that was really negative about the church, or you would face excommunication. Can you kind of like fill us up to date? You just said that there was a stake president knocked on your door and said, we have to have a meeting, a disciplinary council. Was that recently? And kind of how has your attitude changed over the past 10 years towards church discipline, I guess, is my ultimate question.
Well, I was never told not to publish stuff. I was disfellowshipped in 2004, 2 years after my book had come out, by a stake president who didn't believe in excommunication. That's why I think I was spared. He had never excommunicated anyone, and so that's the way things set. I said I don't think it's a good idea to have a court on me. I says there's some. I didn't use it as a threat at all. I didn't even mention. I just says that I'd really like to. I don't think this will do much good for the church or for me. And it proved true. I got a peptic ulcer out of the deal, and they got 600 newspaper coverage all over the world, even in China.
Wow.
I don't think they bargained for that. And so I said to my stake president, I says, well, you know, my book was only selling 75 copies a month until this court came along, and then it jumped up to 1,000 a month. And I says, you can thank yourself for it penetrating the grassroots of the church. So anyway, it kind of went on, and then in 2010, I resigned in 2010. They were going to hold a court. They said they must hold a court. And I had the church handbook, even the new one. And I knew that wasn't true. But I think the strengthening church committee said, you know, do it. And they never tell anyone to excommunicate a person. They just say, have you seen these articles or this article? And then they think because it's coming down, the stake president thinks because it came down from on high that he better do something about it. Kind of works that way. And so I just said to him, I says, well, look, I just as soon fade away like an old soldier, like Douglas MacArthur said. And I'll tell you what, let's not hold the court, and I'll just fade away. I won't give any more interviews or TV appearances or write any more articles and what have you. He said, no, we must hold the court. So I'd been through a six-hour court, literally from 7 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon in 2004, and I knew I wasn't going to do that again. You know, 15 against 1, I felt like a lion in a den of Daniels. So that's the way it went down, and it's a different state president. The first one is from Harvard. He was pretty decent. This last one is, they're good people, in a sense. You know, they try to do what's right, but they don't know anything about the history of the church. This current stake president is a pots and pans salesman. He sells dry goods to Rite Aid and things of that nature. And frankly, I've forgotten more about church history, and he knows. That's not bragging. That's just a fact. I've been studying this for 50 years. And they think they know these things, but they don't know anything about what we talk about and what's on the internet. There's chapel Mormons and the internet Mormons are becoming more informed, but the chapel Mormons, they're like Catholics. They're creating large numbers of Mormon-like Catholics that just don't read anything. They don't go on the internet. But that's changing because the old folks are dying and the young people are on the internet. I don't know if that's probably enough for this. So I've done a lot of stuff in the last 2 years because I figured I had nothing to lose.
The gal in the hat, I think, was the... And then you're next.
Yeah, am I on? Speaking from never having been a Mormon, the first time I read the Book of Mormon, I was familiar with the Bible. I picked up on those verses you were talking about. Of course, just as the people in his day did, who could read and were familiar with the Bible. And the verse that you referred to, when I was already outraged before I got there, but when I got to that particular one, not only had they paraphrased, they had changed the words of Jesus to be more grandiose than they actually are in the Bible, which if you are a believing person, that's blasphemy, to take the words of Jesus and to rewrite them as your own and to change them. So he not only stole them from the Bible, he rewrote them, which is blasphemy according to that definition. But further than that, I don't know if it's true statement for all cults, but this particular one is organized crime, in my opinion, very clearly organized crime that is hiding behind the facade of religion. It is powered by the innocence of the dupes. That's where it gets its power. That's where it draws its money. That's who it is. What do you call it? That's who it gets his money from. You know, the Cosa Nostra gets it from the local whatever businessman down the street. These people at the top are not innocents. And not just going back to Joseph Smith, but your people all along. I'm sorry if this hurts somebody's feelings. I mean, who took the papyrus in and put it in a hidden place?
Do you have a question?
No, I'm sorry. I just wanted to further that discussion. Well, and as far as the question about, didn't some people know that originally, the very first people, yes, he was looking for dupes. He wasn't looking for the people who could recognize those verses. He was looking for the people who didn't, so he could traumatize them and abuse them. But he also had his people that were in on it with him at the top.
I think a lot of us who've done a lot of the reading do know that. My personal opinion is that regardless of what his motivation was, most human beings become more accountable as they go along sometimes in the things that they create. I think a lot of people don't start out to be, although the history shows that Joseph was good at being a con long before he wrote the Book of Mormon. From this point on, can we ask that you ask a question if you have the mic? We don't have that much time.
And I know several of you do have questions. Go ahead.
Is it on then?
Yeah. Actually, my question requires a bit of speculation, and I kind of wanted to go back to that that thing about apologism for the church. It used to be, you know, when I grew up in the 50s and 60s in the church, and, you know, you used to discuss what were then commonly called the mysteries, and you accepted what Brigham Young said about something or what Heber C. Kimball said about something or something like that, you know, and you were always going back to the Journal of Discourses and looking at things to try to round out your knowledge of things. And this would be in Sunday school classes. And then as correlation crept in over a period of years, things were distilled down further and further and further. I understand it's pretty watered down now. And then the way of operating became that the church authorities would say nothing but kind of depend on the apologists to do the answering. And then if an apologist kind of screwed up or said something that got bad press, then they could say, well, it's just an apologist. It didn't come from church sources. So if now we've exhausted the previous one and now and perhaps are moving away from apologism, where is the church going to go then? And this is what I say, it requires a bit of speculation. Where might they go to now answer people's questions as they arise?
I'll give a little bit of that just simply because I think I probably have been intending, probably closer. While the apologist stuff may not necessarily be out in front during the Sunday school lessons, I have seen in the manuals really funny things that are just little snippets here and there when they're expounding on Book of Mormon verses that you know come from the apologists' answers. But they're just really slight things here like, well, Captain Moroni would have been a captain for, you know, this kind of army, and these would have been the kind of tactics that he would have used that would have been Native American tactics at the time. It's things like that that you see, just really gentle, subtle weavings of the research and the apologetics, but it doesn't come right out and say there is no evidence that any of this stuff ever took place. It's just all couched in, oh, Native American stuff.
Kind of like President Hinckley when he dedicated the Mountain Meadows Massacre, when he made an allusion to the moccasins that had walked here. In other words, they're still trying to make it look like it was really the Indians who did it. They do that a lot.
Okay, another question. Mark?
Just real quick, and I'd like to address it to Grant. It will be a question. I read somewhere a couple of months ago that the church is going to be going through something that's going to take, I guess, about 20 or 30 years. And when this plan comes to fruition, it's going to be like Mormonism Mark II. And it entails a couple of things where they're just burying all of the doctrines, whether controversial or not, as deeply as they possibly can, just watering down everything. And then part two, which is going to take that 20 to 30 years, is they're waiting for all the present faithful to die off so that when they come out with this Mormonism Mark II, it will look very much like mainstream Christianity. Have you heard anything about that, or is this just internet, you know, Bigfoot stuff?
I haven't. The church is trying to distance themselves from all past prophets, presidents.
That's already happening.
Yeah, it's here. It's not speculation. It's you know, years ago, it used to be the first presidency had was in charge of most of the areas of the church. Now it's the Quorum of the Twelve. That's shifted from, say, David O. McKay's time. Now they like to have a joint statement before anything can be authoritative. It has to be 15, not just the first presidency. So you're going to have less change. They want... You see, their own past is all there, the Journal of Discourses and John Taylor's view that the blacks are followers of Satan in the pre-earth life. That doesn't go over too well. And so they say, well, that was his opinion, and no one has taught that since. Brigham Young taught Adam God, but no successor. And on that one, they're right. But on this reason the blacks couldn't hold the priesthood, they all says, well, it's something they did in the pre-earth life. But now they're saying, well, we don't know. They want to get away from their answers in the past. In fact, Richard Bushman is going around. He's a historian, more of an apologist historian, I think. He's going around saying, well, you know, stay in the church in 20 years, all this stuff will be commonplace. I'm not sure I believe that, but there'll be a certain amount of that true. Or he's saying, well, you know, stay in the church even if it's false. They're definitely watering things down. I think these are things that are already in place, but I haven't heard about that specific organization.
Well, I have a son who knows nothing of Joseph Smith's polygamy. He's been through 4 years of seminary. I surprised him with it. It's just by omission that they can accomplish those things.
Some of what my talk was yesterday about the meetings that Mitt Romney has had with some of the really far right groups and the ways in which Mormonism, I think, has kind of reached out more than has been reached to coordinate some things with a lot of the Protestant, again, mostly pretty far right Protestant groups. And I really believe that the church is so arrogant that they believe they're using them to eventually get control, and I think they're in for a big surprise, because even when you take the numbers that are involved in pretty right-wing Protestantism, I mean, they're so much more huge than anything the church can compare to. So I think in that way they are, you know, trying to become a little bit more mainline, but I think they have an agenda for that that's deeper than what appears on the surface.
Hi. Good morning. So this is for Grant. Most of the research on Joseph Smith, all the good scholarly work, is, I feel like, 1827 to 1844. I think part of that is because once the church was started, we have a lot more documentation that we can look at and find. But I'm wondering if you've done research more into, like, 1805 to 1827, like, what was influencing him, like, what he was doing when he was, like, 12 or 13. Like, I looked at the Palmyra Register at the New York Library. In 1819, there's, like, an advert that says somebody lost their pocketbook, their wallet, and inside of it was an IOU from Joseph Smith and Joseph Smith Jr. for $3, which in today's money is, like, $50. And I don't know. Haven't heard anybody writing about any like that period. Or have you researched that? Or is there a resource you can point to that does?
I think Michael Quinn's done the most on the early life. I think Bushman has done a little bit on the ancestor of Joseph Smith. What was he doing when he was 12 years old? He was treasure digging. The family, they're all into this. They're a dysfunctional family. Joseph Smith Sr. has a very serious problem with alcoholism. Alvin's kind of the leader of the family, and he dies. They're a dispossessed, dysfunctional family. Most of the church follows Lucy, and three or four of the children join the Presbyterians. Joseph's father is a universalist who believes everybody will eventually go to heaven. Joseph is kind of in line with that and tilts a little towards the Methodists. So you got a dysfunctional family religiously. They have no money. In fact, there's this interesting statement that when Joseph brought the plates home in September of 27, Lucy said, "We didn't have a shilling in the house." They're very poor. They have no respectability, they have no social standing, they have no economic clout and no political clout, and they're functionally a dysfunctional family. So I think when Alvin dies, Joseph kind of takes the leadership. He was a natural leader. They'd do anything to make money. They would sell have a root beer stand if they're having a revival or something in town. They just...
He was in Salem? That he spent in Salem after his leg surgery? I don't know. Oh, I was just like, is there research done on like what he was doing in Salem? Like just like more like when he after his leg surgery, right? He went to the seaside to recover. No? Did that happen, right?
Well, yeah, there's been individual articles about it. I don't know there's been a really good book put together on Joseph Smith's early life from 1805 to say 1820. Not that I'm aware of. Somebody could do one. I'm passing the torch.
Yeah, I have a feeling. Okay.
I would like to ask you, beyond all the hiding, all the twisting, all the rearranging that has been done, I'm 71, and I was born and raised in the church, and I see a huge amount of this, which wasn't available before. But what I want to know, do you think they will ever say that they don't have a revelation about eternal marriage nor the power, and that Joseph Smith really did not see this, but we're a good church, and we do a lot of good, and stay with us. But even though the Book of Mormon is fiction.
I think, don't take this wrong way, but I think if they were to say that, your generation would have to die. I think that it would have to be something where the generation that really had a lot of just Book of Mormon, Book of Mormon, Book of Mormon, Book of Mormon would have to just pass away first. My dad and my grandmother have had conversations about how disgusted they are with the community of Christ for leaving, for saying exactly what you have, and they feel far more superior because the church has held on to Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon so strongly. And I've heard snippets of that from other people within the older generation. So,
can I just follow up? Just sociologically, the churches that are the ones that are growing are the strict churches. They're the ones that are adhering to their doctrines in a very strict way. They're the ones that are forcing the congregants to adhere to these the same doctrines. So I don't know much about Mormonism, but I think any church that would kind of twist that or just come out and say, you know, nah, this is not really so true, but we're still good, stay with us. Just from a sociological perspective, they don't really stand a chance.
One other comment. We're seeing it happen. It may be subtle, but it's only when necessary. It's only when necessary. If the church crunches numbers and finds that people don't like the temple ceremony, they change it. But only then. And to admit the Book of Mormon is pious fiction will be when it's, if a doctor tells you, look, I have to amputate your leg or the whole body dies. But they're not to that point yet. When they do, then they will cut it loose.
Yeah, the church will never formally announce the things you're suggesting. They'll just quietly disappear if that's what they want. And most LDS will follow the prophet or whatever he says. They'll have their losses. And they have the very great example that is mentioned down here about what happened to the RLDS church. I know those. I know their leaders. I know they're historians. They lost 25,000 people because they were, you know, they're going to give women the priesthood, and they got two or three apostles that are females now and allow gay rights. This just drove the kind of orthodox group right to become independent branches. And they says, we're still our LDS community of Christ, but we're not paying our money to, you know,
headquarters.
And their tithing kind of dried up, and they've had to lay a lot of people off. And look, they have a different dynamic going. The top of their church and the historians were together, and that's why they were able to change. In the LDS church, you've got the leaders of the church and the people allied together, and the historians are over here. At least a good many of them are. That's a much more difficult situation. So I don't think they're going to announce anything. They'll just slowly let things pass away. But, you know, I've heard that among the Quorum of the Twelve, there's a lot of them who would like to be more open about our history. But there's others that, of course, do not. And until Boyd K. Packard dies, I don't think there's going to be anything along that line. But they have to have unanimity, as I said last night, and that's hard to do.
I think there's one other major factor that will affect all that, and that's the enormous financial corporation that the church is. I mean, when I think about the future, I think, I wonder if this will just eventually become, you know, let's say two generations from now, just a huge business that has some past history that it was a church. I don't know how they could disincorporate the financial part of it. I think there's always going to have to be the church that is the cover for the financial. And so I think it's a real twisted history. No. They're worried about the money.
It's numbers.
The numbers and the money.
That's all missions ever were, numbers. That's all we ever did.
And if they get too progressive, the fundamentalist church just thrive. They say, oh, you're an apostasy mainline church. And if they don't, if they're not progressive, then they're afraid they'll get criticism from the other side. They're a very, very cautious organization. All leaders are the next three apostles after Monson, who's 85 and has dementia. The next three after that are 90. And
Alzheimer's.
I think so.
That's what I think too.
At least that's what people inside tell me. But you're going to have a president that's going to eventually be 100 years old. Well, he can't travel much, can he?
Sue just asked me to make sure we understand. 11, we're done, and we got about 15 minutes. Next question.
Okay. First of all, I want to thank you all for your contribution this weekend. This has been fantastic. I've been coming to this program since 2002, and obviously we're having an effect. I mean, it appears that the church is unraveling. I have two questions. First of all, I live up in Meridian, Idaho, and they just announced another temple up there in Meridian, and it just boggles my mind. I'd like to get some input. What are they doing with these temples? We hear that, you know, they can't get the attendance where it used to be, but yet they're still building more and more of them. I'd like to know what the MO is behind that. And secondly, you know, we're faced with the possibility of having a Mormon president here coming up. Do you think that would be more detrimental to the church? Do you think it would put the church under even more of a microscope for people like us to get the word out? Or do you think the church will use that? Obviously, they'll try to use that to their advantage. But I'd like to get your thoughts on those, both of those things, if you could, please.
The MIC temples are for really good PR. And they're also good for getting the they're good for getting those little bursts of huzzah from the membership. When the Brigham City Temple opened, it was very exciting for the members around that area. Whether or not the temple actually gets used, wasn't really the point. The point was that the membership got excited and it seemed like it was very, very needed. And Mormons all over Facebook, you know, we got to see that. We got to see that excitement. So that's the first one. And then the second question was
Romney.
In my opinion, because it is such a microscope that will come under, that for the first little while, Romney will not be able to do anything that deals specifically with the church if he hopes to have a second term. Now, of course, that assumes that Romney is logical and rational, but that's just really politically, that is how you would win a second term, is that you wouldn't give the worst fears to everyone who's voting for him the first time to give that specific credence. So that's my opinion. If he is smart and he wants a second term and he does win, assuming all of that, he it won't be the Mormonism thing that is pushed.
Yeah, I'd just like to add to that. I think if Romney wins the presidency and does a good job and the people like it, it will help Mormonism in some ways. If he does a bad job, then that could, I don't know, go the other direction. For those of us who know what he believes, it makes you worry a little bit of his decision-making in office. I agree. I don't think that the church is going to put the heavy hand on him, and I think he will not look to help the church because then he knows that's going to be scrutinized. I want to say something about the other question. What was it?
The temples.
Okay, I can't verify this, but I have a pretty good source high up in the church office building on this. Temples are money makers. The way they do that is that they take the existing temple district and they cut it in half and they see how much tithing comes in on that second half. And if they get enough tithing to pay for the new temple in 9 months, they'll build it. It's a moneymaker. It's a prestige thing. And it shows we're growing. It keeps the members thinking, man, we're really rolling along here. But you're right. After about a year and a half of a temple, the attendance goes way down. I know that happened to San Diego Temple. And I happened to go to a meeting, and they were berating the members, saying, you need to go down there on Saturday. You need to do this. And, you know, wanting more of their time. So I think it's a money-making thing. It's an image thing. And the church is very interested in image, as all of you know. And they'll continue to build them. Well, they got 150 of them now. I think once they need to be repaired, the local temple district has to remodel them, don't they, with their own money? Somebody said that's why the Idaho Falls Temple remodel was kind of slow.
We're going to go till 11, so probably two or three more questions.
I heard that the president of the church and the 12 apostles, that they live the law of consecration, and that when they come into these offices, that they sign over everything they have. Is there any fact to that?
I would doubt it highly. They probably put their things into a trust, you know, it's managed if they have anything of great value, so that they can't be accused of mingling funds, or the church can't be accused of any of that. And that's typical for people who get involved in a corporation or in a political office. I've never heard that. Has anyone else on the panel?
I would say that, and of course this is total speculation or whatever, but it just seems odd to me that the few members that are super high up that don't have their lawyer degrees, who might be just teachers, are living in really nice houses in really nice neighborhoods of Salt Lake City. So whether or not they live the law of consecration, that part that's consecrated back to them would be quite nice. The other thing, too, that would be very interesting is, why then write the books and then push them through Deseret Industries so heavily? And I don't mean that like, I mean, if you were thinking about it from a believer's perspective, it's, oh, well, they have to share the stuff. But if you've actually read those books, they're nothing new. They're saying the same stuff. They're just taking from each other, and it's just this giant pool of no new ideas whatsoever. But they still sell all those books because members think that they have to have them. So where is all that money going from those proceeds?
Did you have a comment, Grant, on that?
Well, people don't make money selling books.
That is absolutely true, and I understand that completely.
That's about it.
All right.
There is a lot of prestige in having books out, though, and I'm guessing that's a lot of the motivation. And maybe they're given some sort of quota, you know, from the presidency to keep grinding them out.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know Siegel Books is now merged with Deseret Book, and really? Bookcraft is owned by the church. I used to work for Bookcraft when I was a young return missionary, but the founder of Siegel Book his name was Coford, and when I tried to get my book published there, the answer was, or a book on Jesus actually, he says, well, we don't want to try anything really new. The old formula just keeps working, and it's the same old thing, and we're doing just fine, so no, we're not interested in... And that's kind of what they do. They don't have anything groundbreaking or innovative. They're doing just fine with the sales, I guess, to the faithful of the repeats. And it's been that way for decades and decades.
I've got a question here. My question, I think, is probably mostly directed to Wade. I think you've got the most experience here. Masturbation.
Well played, sir. Well played. No,
what I'd like to know is, okay, first of all, the church tends to refer to it commonly as self-abuse, which I don't understand because, okay, it doesn't feel abusive. And it's disturbing to me that the church on a regular basis asks, you know, 12 and 14 and 16-year-old boys and girls, but mostly boys, and I personally know of a few bishops that have told me point blank, they don't even approach a subject with girls. So they just don't. Young women, they do not ask them if they have a problem with self-abuse. I'm sure some of you have had different experiences, but a majority, I think, of bishops do not ask girls if they masturbate. They do ask, you know, if you're obeying the law of chastity, and they just leave it at that and hope the girls don't say, well, what does that mean exactly, Bishop? What I'm wondering is, when do any of you think the church will ever get to a point where they come in touch with, pardon the pun, they come in touch with reality over the realism of how common masturbation is? My father served in a mission presidency, and he told me if I interviewed 200 19-year-old missionaries and asked them if you have a problem with self-abuse, maybe one out of every 30 or 40 will tell me, admit that, well, yes, sort of, you know, and they hang their head in shame as if it's, you know, they're one of only 100 that actually does, when in fact, he says, I know 99% of them are lying to me. They're looking me right in the eye, and they're saying, nope, no problem whatsoever. I mean, I actually asked my mission president, asked me about a problem with self-abuse, and I said, it's not a problem, it works fine.
I think, you know, all of this touches so deeply and intimately into really the core of it is that the greatest part about using guilt and shame for masturbation is that it is a control technique, and it is a control technique that touches everybody because everybody touches themselves. That's so when you yeah, I mean, exactly. That's the thing that you get to do. You get to say, you know, you get to say that you are a pervert, And if you really brainwash children, they really truly believe that they are the only ones. And, you know, and that's why dinosaurs died, is because, you know, they touch themselves at night. Which, you know, of course I'm stealing from Family Guy, but whatever. And that's the reason why I don't know if they ever will face reality on that aspect, is because it is such a great control. And if you control people's sexuality, you can control them.
That could be for legal reasons only.
And I think that that's...
Okay. You don't have a mic, I'm sorry.
Okay, I'll just rephrase it. So someone pointed out that as of 2010, the manual no longer has that as a specific question to ask. This is the other direction that they can go. And the reason why they'll go that way is because of money. And the money would come from lawsuits, because eventually people will grow spines and say, you can't be, you know, behind closed doors with my boy or my girl and basically do anything that would be considered not only sexual harassment in the real world, but abusive, you know, abusive. So that's the other direction to go. Now, if you did watch the priesthood session, though, they are still clearly talking about it as a sin. So while they might not necessarily have it written down to ask it, it will probably be practice that a lot of bishops still will. It'll just be known that's just what you do. And then occasionally you'll get a good bishop or a good stake president that has, you know, the moral core and will be like, do you live the law of okay, that's good enough, you know. And that's what will end up happening.
Or keep it under control. One night, late night, I was couldn't sleep, and I turned on the Catholic channel, Mother Angelica. Any of you ever watched her?
That stopped you from masturbating.
and she would take questions. And this came up, what do you think about masturbation? He says, well, I've never known God to give us a toy that he didn't expect us to use.
Amen.
And she says, it's all so handy, isn't it? It's just...
Can I make a comment about this present subject? I happen to be on an email list that consists of just women who are on every spectrum of activity in the church, and they're all very liberal women, and most of them are working. I mean, they're not the typical Mormon woman. And there's a lot of discussion about this very thing, about the bishop's interviews and so forth. And I know that most of these women will not allow their daughter to be in an interview with the priesthood authority without them being present also. And the movement is going that way. I'm seeing that more and more. And I think the parents are the more educated liberal parents are seeing that it is not an appropriate thing for a girl to be alone in a room with an older man to be asked these kinds of questions. And I'm going to be very blunt and say that I truly believe that for some of these priesthood leaders who do this a lot, it's a voyeurism to them. There's a lot of repressed sexuality in the church. In fact, I think most Mormons are repressed sexually only because, you know, that's the culture that they grow up in, and they're ashamed of their sexuality. And so I'm not blaming the men for being this way. I think it's a natural outcome of the repressed sexuality within Mormonism. And I'm happy to see it. I just think that the more and more parents who stand up for the rights of their teenage children. I don't know if you've ever read Raptor's book online, but he talks about, I mean, his whole story is about abuse, psychological, emotional abuse in the mission field to begin with. And I started collecting stories years ago about that, and I'm going to continue, because that's a whole nother chapter in the church. There is so much abuse in the church. Go ahead. This is the last question.
Okay, the question I have, primarily is directed at Wade. The question, it occurred to me after hearing you discuss, let's call PTSD, a traumatic stress disorder, and the language was in the effect that this is an unrealized cost of war at the present, or historically at least. I mean, war costs X number of dollars, but into that equation never enters the treating the individuals who go to the war and don't die at that time, but nonetheless suffer perhaps lifelong psychological problems that need treatment. My question is related to that topic, missions. And although I one time was a missionary and several people in my family were, it's interesting that it seems as though several of them suffer symptoms that would be consistent with trauma. And that being said, the corporation never bears that cost. So I wonder if you think that's a real factor in what it actually costs to do missionary stuff.
I think that's a really good idea that needs to be brought out, because within the church there are so many things that just absolutely cost them nothing, and one of which is missionary work is quite cheap for them, because you pay and then you go and work, and so you are not just a volunteer that gets paid for by the corporation, but you pay your way and then you go and work. And it's very, very clear that anything that happens to you or on your mission is your own problem afterwards, and that's just how it is. One of the other disturbing things that happened in Germany with me was that we went to the hospital, we went to, I had to go to the hospital, I had to have surgery and all of this stuff, and I was worried about the cost of that. And people kept telling me, don't worry, the church has got it, the church has got it, the church has got it. Well, the thing was, and I was young and I was dumb, the church didn't have that. I went to Germany. The German people paid for that. They're the ones that paid for that. The church didn't pay a thing. And then when I came home and still had to have tests, didn't pay for any of that. Same thing with all my psychological treatment, didn't pay for anything of that. So, yeah, it is a very good question, because it brings to light this missionary work that is a cult. It's, if you believe the church is a cult, then it's a cult within a cult, and they have to pay for almost nothing.
When my youngest son went on his mission, I had just been divorced, and his father dropped him from our insurance policy, and he went through his 2 years in the mission field with no insurance and had a very severe medical problem that he put off until he got home, and that's a whole other story. But what I found out in calling the church before he left on his mission, because I knew he wouldn't have insurance, was that I said, now what if a missionary is actually in a car wreck and is paralyzed for life? And what I was told is that the church would pay up to $20,000 of care after he gets home, and after that they'll pay nothing. So if the missionary was not covered by insurance in the mission field, he would have been, of course, a ward of the state as far as medical care for the rest of his life. We're going to have to end. People got planes to catch and roads to get on. This has been really great to have this. I think this has been a really good thing to do this time, to be able to delve a little further into some of the things we discussed. I wish you well and good safe journey home, and hopefully we will see you next year.
She wants to read her little poem. She forgot.
I know. If you don't mind, it's short, though. All right. When I stood up for my postimony,
I wanted to read a poem, and the reason why it was important to me is because I lost my voice when I went back to the church after I got married and tried to really entrench myself. I had been a poet and was along that track, and finally gaining the confidence and the support of people here, I decided to go back. And this also rounds out kind of my journey, and it's more not so much about the LDS church, but anyway, I use a word cold, as in K-O-H-L, so coal is in eye makeup, and I have a quote that I found online that I use from, written by Janet Howe Gaines, called How Bad Was Jezebel? And the title is, For They Have Sown the Wind, and They Shall Reap the Whirlwind. For they have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. Unlike the many voiceless biblical wives and concubines whose muteness reminds us of the powerlessness of women in ancient Israel, Jezebel has a tongue. Jezebel had a tongue before the dogs devoured it. She coaled her lids, dressed her hair, spat on Elijah and his God. Then the eunuchs helped her out the upper window, her flung body askew, horse-trampled. Soon only hands and feet and a skull picked clean. The gift of bones left behind, often the lone testament when the voice is gone, ripped from its roots, carried away by dogs. You, Deuteronomists, were among that pack who lapped the blood-spattered wall, like who snapped her up like scraps pushed from a table, who wagged tails for centuries, intending to rend her, digested and dung scattered. You couldn't wholly destroy her, and in the attempt, you, all of you, bear testament of the queen with cold eyes who lives still in your lines, and especially the blanks between. It's your yapping, your howling, swallowed in the din like so much wind. Your faces nod from their skulls, each indistinguishable from the rest. Deuteronomous, you reaped the temptress, and now you are left, if not dead, as dying dogs, with your lying with your tails between your legs, while Jezebel ascends in the whirlwind. Thank you.